I'm Bill Barole. Over the last few decades, I've done every kind of writing there is to do, from journalism to humor, books, movies, and television.
I'm Matt Ricardo. For the last 30 years, I've toured the world as a variety performer.
We've come together across the Atlantic to talk about creativity, what it is, where it comes from, why it matters.
Thomas Edison said, "To invent, you need a good imagination and a pile of junk."
This is Imagination and Junk, a conversation about the hard work of creativity.
Episode 18, Salad Bar.
Dear Bill, for 2.5 seasons of this podcast, we've been trying to break down as many aspects of creativity as we can. From daily routines to inspirations, motivations, and of course, the right notebook. But all of that stuff comes from one starting point. All of creativity grows from one seed, the original idea. There is no better feeling than having an idea, whether it flashes into your mind seemingly out of nowhere, or is the destination of a long meandering train of thought. It feels fizzy and exciting. Suddenly your brain has a map to the next place. There is work to be done, and you know where to start. An idea is the letting go of a pulled bow. It exists to propel something forward. It's a nice feeling, is my point. However, in this episode, I'm going to posit a question. That original idea, the undeniable heart of all creative work, does it actually exist? Now, of course, I'm not denying that ideas exist. They do. But is there such a thing as a completely original idea? I'm going to say no. We are, of course, the sum of our life experience. Everything we've seen, heard, eaten, loved, and been hurt by. Everywhere we've been, everyone we've met, every conversation we've had, every word we've read, every second of all of our lives up until right now is what has made us what and who we are. And what and who we are is what we draw on when we're being creative. But it's not just that. The genre or art form that we choose to create in, whatever it might be, that also has its own life experience. Everything created in that genre, everyone who worked within it, subverted it, contributed to it, misunderstood it, they all shaped the version of it that existed by the time you found it. So, with this in mind, is it possible to make something artistic that is completely original? Or is everything, either consciously or unconsciously, but inevitably, a remix of what came before it? Example. And let's do the most obvious one. You're at a party at 1530 Sedgwick Avenue in the Bronx, New York City, in 1973. Cindy Campbell invited you. It's her party, and her brother Clive is playing the music. He's got two turntables and two copies of the same record, and he's playing his favourite part of one record while rewinding the other record to play the same part again, over and over, seamlessly. He's playing the records like an instrument and making new music. Clive calls himself DJ Cool Herc, and he just invented one of the pillars of hip-hop. Example number two. Take two old things and mix them together to make one new thing. Sitcoms haven't really changed much in their rhythms and settings since the first one, Pinwright's Progress, which was British, you're welcome, and told the story of the daily life of the manager of a small shop. Documentaries, specifically TV documentaries, have a massively recognisable production style. Handheld cameras so they can capture things as they happen, interviews with the participants afterwards, those same participants being unsure of how to behave when a camera crew enters their lives. We know those two formats so well that when something like The Office combines them and shows us a sitcom that looks like a documentary, it feels like something completely fresh. It wasn't fresh, of course. Woody Allen did something similar in 1969, and then there's Spinal Tap. But on TV, The Office was new enough and popular enough that for a while, Every new sitcom stole the style, regardless of how much sense it made in the narrative of each show. The Office's style of remixing its sources dominated TV in the same way that hip-hop dominates popular music. And neither tried to disguise their influences, and I think that's important. When DJ Kool Herc cross-faded between those records, he didn't claim to have written and recorded the stuff on the track any more than a pianist pretends they built the piano. Everyone has influences. It's all about how you use them. Last example. I've managed to carve a little niche for myself these past few decades by having an act and a style that is seen as being fairly unique. And sure, the end result is. But the ingredients that made me, nothing new at all. So, here is what I am. I'm juggling from Chris Cremo, Rob Murray and Bobby May. The way I stand on stage is from one of my mentors, Peter John, although I never realised it until my wife watched him work and pointed it out. When I talk on stage, it's Paddy Bramwells, Eric Morecambe, David Letterman and so many others. I dress well because Cary Grant and Bob Monkhouse did. I move well because Gene Kelly and Fred Astaire did. I fall down well because Alex Dandridge and Jacques Tati did. I know when to deadpan because of the dozens of times I watched the great Tony Anthony out-deadpan the world. I know how to turn an audience against me and then turn them back thanks to professional wrestling. And the little hop step I do in the middle of my cigar box routine is lifted from my friend William Regal. He spotted that once and really enjoyed letting me know. There are thousands more ingredients, but that's what they are, ingredients to make something new. I have one trick in my act that's completely, totally my creation, and even that's a development of something that already existed. Everything else is a sound on a record, mixed with others. Looped, scratched, reversed, so you wouldn't recognize it. Something new now. So, Bill, here's the question. Is all culture, all of it, always and forever, remix? Talk to you soon. Matt.
Dear Matt, you've got me thinking about originality. Specifically, I'm turning over in my mind the question you've raised. Is all culture remix? If that's true, it raises an intriguing possibility, which is, if it was possible to go back far enough, to somehow untangle all the threads and undo all the connections, to unwind every act that built on every other act that had gone before, eons and eons, time out of mind, wouldn't it stand to reason that there was one singular first act of creativity, and that the greatest and only real pure inventor in the long history of creativity on Earth was some beetle-browed Homo sapien? So, it's 400,000 years ago, a Tuesday. Guy's tramping the African plains looking for food to sneak up on, and he spots something stirring in the tall grass by the tree line. It's a red deer, and it's got a distinctive tear in its ear, right where he winged the last red deer he saw before it took off and hid. And he thinks, same one. And he wonders, what did it do between then and now? Where did it go? Was it rattled? Did it lie low? Try to get to safe ground? Try to find its family? In that moment, he's telling himself a story. It's the first story, the first song, the first poem, the first painting. It's the Big Bang of creativity. You may have noticed that I weaseled out of answering your big question just now, is all culture remix? In my own defense, let me note that what I just did, riffing on a big topic at the outset of a piece of writing to set up the moment when I inevitably circle back and confront it head on, is a technique I copped from the great Newsweekly writers who came before me, principally a guy named Jerry Adler, who could shuck and jive his way into a piece so charmingly that you'd almost forget what he was writing about. It's a variation on the classic color lead, and it works every time. And now I've slipped the punch a second time. So let me answer you directly, finally. Is all culture remix? Sure, why not? We are in every sense the product of a gazillion inputs, and I'm hard-pressed to think why that would be any different in our creative lives. I have a tendency to high blood pressure because my father had one, and his father. Is it really such a stretch to think that the idea I had for how to start this piece is the end result of a million creative decisions made by me and a long line of people who've done what I do? I chose a color lead because Jerry Adler did, and he chose it because Calvin Trillin chose it. and Calvin Trillin chose it because somebody chose it before him. Maybe that fizzy little charge you talked about when you get a new idea and it seems promising, maybe that's the electrical impulse of that lineage in our brains, and even deeper down, in what anthropologists call racial memory. It is, I agree, a distinct and a pleasurable sensation to have. I always know I'm onto something when I feel it. It's the starting gun for every creative endeavor. However, here's where I disagree with you. You said that when you have an idea, it's exciting because your brain has a map to the next place. But does it? I'd argue that your brain has a fuzzy picture of a possible outcome. The map, the route to be traveled to get there, well, that's another thing entirely. In fact, if we really want to dig into the metaphor, and what the hell, why not? There is no map, because creativity is a process, not an act, and every process of creation is its own map, or rather, creativity is itself the map. And in between acts of creation, we tear up the old ones to write new ones. That's what creativity is. That's why it's energizing and exhausting and exhilarating and depressing. We're walking on fresh ground every time we do it. Our senses are alive when we're creating because they have to be, because we don't know where we're going. And what really breaks your brain about all that is that when you get to that next place, you find out that not only did you not have a clue about the route you've traveled, you were most likely wrong about the destination, too. It doesn't look like you thought it was going to look. It's new, because you birthed it, and every birth is different. So maybe, are there any new ideas, is the wrong question. I'm not usually one to quote scripture, but this one's a gimme. There is nothing new under the sun, Ecclesiastes 1:9. And if that's true, and I think it is, maybe the right questions are, what do we do with this? How do we feel about it? And maybe most crucially, why do we torture ourselves so endlessly about being original? In the spirit of this question, I'll simply say at this point, right, see you next time. Bill.
Dear Bill, see, that's what I like about these conversations. One of us, in this case me, starts an episode with what I assume to be a challenging question. But instead of debating it through the episode, we immediately agree and go on to the more important and interesting thing, which is, what does it mean? So we concur that all culture is remix. And in the words of the great Beavis and Butthead while watching a U2 video, this means something. But before we get to that, I want to go back to how we got here. It feels like the entire cultural and artistic industry has existed forever by selling a lie about itself. Being an artist is not the invention of something from nothing. It's in knowing which somethings can serve as starting points from which to assemble something new. An artistic life is about cultivating one's landscape of personal influences. That's why the best thing anyone can do to be more creative is to consume more creative work. But that's quite a complicated idea. Much easier to just go along with the common knowledge that some people can just dance with the muse and make a spark happen in darkness. They're special people. They can do the magic of generating something from nothing. But that's not a real thing. Not in science and not in the arts either. So this brings me to a question. Why do we torture ourselves about being original? Ego. It's ego. Ego is the thing that gets us into this in the first place. Let's not forget that. It's not easy to get up in the morning and say, I'm going to be an artist. I'm going to make something. To do that, you need to believe somewhere deep inside that you can, in fact, make something. And ego helps you with that. It helps you keep going through the creative process by whispering in your ear how great you are, how brilliant your ideas are, how correct you are to be spending time doing this. Ego makes you feel pretty special. It's a hell of a drug. But in motivating you with pure uncut confidence, it's also making you forget about all the influences, inspirations, and collaborations that laid down the tarmac on the road you're traveling on. Ego says it's all about you. You're the maker. You're the ideas person. It all comes from you. And that feels nice. It feels like you're a real artist. Society deifies the shiny genius who did or made something nobody ever did before. But by doing this, it tells you a lie about how all that happened. And that's a pity, because there's no shame in citing your influences, in admitting the things and thoughts and people and work that helped you birth an idea. It's the truth of it. It's how it all works, but ego takes that as a personal insult. If you are influenced by things that came before, then you're not so unique and special and shiny and golden, and we can't have that. Ego, originality, these are not perhaps entirely useful concepts. And yes, you're right about the map thing. It's not so much being given a map as it is being turned around to face in a new general direction and then being given a shove. As for that fizzy feeling you get when having an idea, perhaps in real life it's the feeling of synapses making connections, thoughts and memories finding each other in your temporal lobe, shaking hands and sharing stories and making friends. Here's what I choose to believe, though. That fizzy feeling? It's the ghosts of all the people who contributed to the idea you just had. They like that someone remembered what they did. That fizzy feeling is them saying thanks. I mean, it's obviously not, but I'm a romantic. Wait, did I just say, in this episode, just a couple of paragraphs ago, that originality might not be a good thing? So where does that take us? Talk to you soon. Matt.
Dear Matt, I'm starting to detect your modus operandi here. What the hell, we're 18 episodes in, so I guess it's about time. You pose an unanswerable question, lob it up like you're serving a volleyball, and then you more or less peace out, like, okay, well, over to you, I'll be at Craft Services if you need me. I'm just kidding. We don't have Craft Services. But okay. These are the rules of the game, or at least the ones that seem to pertain with extra stickiness in this episode, so I'll play. You ask, immediately before grabbing your hat and well-tailored coat and vanishing out the door, leaving nothing behind but a mat-shaped nimbus of smoke hanging in the air, what if we believe that originality is not a good thing? Where does that take us? I see what you did there. By yoking originality together with ego, a thing that's generally held to be bad, you nudge open the door to arguing that originality is bad, too. It's a bold strategy, Cotton. Let's see if it pays off for you. If originality is bad, it's bad because the quest for originality serves as a brake on creative aspiration. It's the voice that says, screw it, this has been done a million times before, so who needs me to make it a million and one? If ego is bad, it's bad because it denies credit to the million makers who've made iterations of something before you thought to. I gotta admit, though, that because creativity is messy, as we've observed before on this podcast, this is one of those situations where an A-B on-off model doesn't serve us well. Let's look at a couple of examples. You'd be hard-pressed to deny that Frank Sinatra, the greatest vocalist this country ever produced, one of the greatest artists, period, didn't have an ego. People often remark that I'm pretty lucky, Sinatra once said. Luck is only important insofar as getting the chance to sell yourself at the right moment. After that, you've got to have talent and know how to use it. Sinatra was cocky. He was brash. He knew what he had and what it was worth. Was he an original? He probably would have said yes, certainly. Ego does that. But he also went out of his way in performance to acknowledge the songwriters whose work he was about to perform. And he learned how to hold a note, he always said, learned the critical skill for a vocalist of how to breathe by studying bandleader Tommy Dorsey. Sinatra was the young vocalist in Dorsey's band. He was fascinated with the trombonist's breath control. And as he sat behind him on the bandstand, he watched the way the vents in the back of Dorsey's suit coat moved to see when he breathed in and out. Eventually, he figured out that Dorsey was slipping in little inhales through the corner of his mouth as he played. It was a story Sinatra told to the end of his life. You could see him do the same thing when he sang. So Dorsey, the many songwriters whose songbook Sinatra sang. Sinatra specifically, he ritually placed himself in a context. So did Steve Jobs, probably the most revered executive of the last 100 years. Did Jobs have an ego? Oh my goodness, yes. But he always acknowledged his debt to the businessmen, inventors, and tinkerers who came before him. From Intel's Andy Grove and Bob Noyce to Walt Disney and Polaroid's Dr. Edwin Land. He was a national treasure, Jobs said of Land, who in the 1960s brought to market the paradigm-shattering and technically staggering SX70 instant camera after a development process the tech writer Harry McCracken has credibly likened to the Apollo program. I don't understand, Jobs said of Land, why people like that can't be held up as models. This is the most incredible thing to be. Not an astronaut, not a football player, but this. Now, Sinatra and Jobs aren't just creators. You could make a convincing case that they'd be on any Mount Rushmore of creative types. They're super creatives. They're among the goats. So what do we do with people like this? The biggest egos, the most unruly, the most demanding, the most impossible by all accounts. But also the ones who, while they may not always have been personally generous to the people around them day to day, always and very deliberately made a point of acknowledging that they stood in a lineage. If we believe that the Jobses and Sinatras, few as they are the paradigmatic creators, do we not also have to believe that their behavior is the paradigmatic creative behavior? Do we have to hold up as the model this fascinating, unruly mix of personal behavior that's often appalling, but a public stance toward creativity itself that's deliberately generous? Here's what I'm arguing. For people who want to call themselves creators, that's the recipe. It's the model. It's the key that unlocks greatness. Does that make sense? I'll talk to you next time. Bill.
Dear Bill, I've just discovered sliced red peppers dipped in hummus. I'm 54 and a half, and I just last week discovered how delicious this is. This isn't relevant to this week's episode, but I wanted to put it out there to help others because that's the kind of pay-it-forward mensch that I am. Anyway. Okay, maybe it was a little glib and snarky of me to posit the idea that originality is inherently bad. Originality is good, but maybe it's the popular definition of it that's flawed. Let's talk about Frank Sinatra. First things first, I love Frank Sinatra. I love the way he sings, lazily, cocky, loose, easy. And it's all very well for Frankie to say that luck is only a factor in getting to the point where you can sell yourself, but Frank was a white guy in America in the 30s and 40s, so there were more people buying what he was selling. His luck wasn't the same as everyone's. But you're right. He did cite his influences. I'll give him that. Somehow he found a way to be monumentally, aggressively protective of his position at the top, while at the same time name-checking those whose songs he sung and whose careers inspired him. The chairman of the board was okay with thanking his staff. Steve Jobs, though. Hoo boy. There's someone who really tests the remix theory. He took the mouse, icon, Windows, etc. from Xerox. He took the designs for desktop computer cases, iPhone apps and the iPod from the work of Braun designer Dieter Rams. He took the idea of iTunes from SoundJam. He took multi-touch screens from Fingerworks. The iPad was taken from British designer Roger Fidler. Even the name iPad was being used by both Fujitsu and Magtech a decade before Apple. Apple admitted taking the idea from the iPod from Kane Kramer, who invented a very similar device in 1979, but they still declined to pay him anything for it. Jobs even stole $4,500 from his partner, Steve Wozniak, way back when they created a video game together for Atari. He ended up paying him only $350. I mean, at this point, it's probably safe to assume he shoplifted the turtlenecks. I could go on for an entire episode about all the ways Steve Jobs has been a crappy human, but I don't want to do that. Okay, I kind of do want to do exactly that, but that's not why we're here. The point is, the line between confidence in yourself and psychopathic arrogance is flimsy and gossamer. Sinatra and Jobs are both incredibly important, influential people who have changed the course of human history, but they were both also, it has to be said, assholes. You seem to be arguing that the overbearingly unpleasant, manipulative jerk-hattery often, and perhaps has to, go along with being an influential creative, but I can't quite sign on to that. I think it does go along with the modern vision of the singular creative tyrant, the toxic genius that seems to now be the default personality for anyone publicly successful, the Elon Muskification of the celebrity boss, but I think all that's just boring showbiz and nothing really to do with being successful or creative. I counter that archetype and the notion that creative success favours a shitty personality type with the British writer Michael Rosen. Nobody can question his level of creativity in terms of output, more than 140 books, and quality. Appointed Children's Laureate. Awarded so many honorary doctorates I literally don't have time to list them. Awards from bodies as diverse as the French government, associations of teachers, of nurses, piles of literary awards, including the Pen Prize for outstanding literary merit for his life's work. He is an activist and campaigner for education, the NHS and many other causes. When his son died, he wrote Sad Book, to simultaneously help himself through the grief and help readers understand theirs. My wife was once at one of the many events where Rosen reads his work to kids. She told me that when this crumpled little dude came into the back of the room and walked down to the stage to read, the kids reacted like the biggest pop star on the planet had just arrived. Children adore him because they love his stories and, for want of a better word, his spirit. That's the kind of creative to aim to be. Oh, and to bring us back to the theme for this episode, he's very open about his influences, specifically the American poet Carl Sandburg. Okay, now we're back from that diversion. What's my bottom line about originality and remix? The whole, this has been done a million times before, so who needs me to make it a million and one thing, misses the point. The fact that it's you making the million and one version of something means that you're already changing it. It's your lens, your hands making it, your brain remembering it. It's going to be exactly as much the million and one old thing as it is the number one first new thing. It's both at the same time. Everything is. And the more you remember that and like it, the more you'll make it that. I think. Okay, bring this one home, Bill. I'll talk to you soon. Matt.
Dear Matt. Yeah, okay. I might have been reaching with Steve Jobs. Because the rhetorical overreach is a time-tested narrative technique. And yes, I stand in a lineage. In this case, a lineage of overreachers. So let me course correct. Jobs. And you sort of flicked at this, so let me make it explicit because it's my overreach to buy back. Jobs, based on the success of Apple, enjoys a reputation as the greatest computer man in history, when that title should properly go to the infinitely more amiable, modest, and unassuming Steve Wozniak. It was Woz who was the builder, who had in his fingertips the spark of genius when it came to knowing which wire to solder where on a circuit board, while Jobs was the schmoozer. Now, I'm not saying it didn't take both to midwife Apple into existence and carry it past the rocky shoals of its early life, but if we're talking about Jobs in the lineage of tinkerers, no. We should really be talking about Woz. But Jobs did something, well, he did a few things, to burnish his own reputation. He cultivated it mercilessly while he was alive. And then he died, securing his place in the firmament and rendering any posthumous reevaluation difficult and a little unseemly. But maybe your litany of ideas which Jobs, let's say, borrowed to make Apple. Maybe there's a lesson buried in there. And maybe it's the one to take away as we wrap this episode up. That list tells a story, and it is a story of absolute brazenness. Is that what we've been looking for? Is that what makes a great creator? A willingness to look you in the eye and tell you how much you mean to him, even as he picks your pocket? Here's what I think. Jobs nodded to the tech giants who were his inspirations because nodding is easy. It isn't always, but it can be, and I'm going to suggest that it was in Jobs' case, a way of cosplaying humility to misdirect from the ways in which a creative person has plundered those others' work. And what does that suggest but fragility? An overweening belief in creating, polishing, and maintaining a fiction that one has as you put it, danced with the muse, when the reality is much more quotidian than that. The reality is, creativity is a salad bar, and it takes a healthy ego to stand up and say, "God damn it, I love a salad bar. I love picking and choosing from what's been laid out for me." That's where we can come down, I think, on the role of ego and originality in creativity. It's the unhealthy creative ego that stands up before the world, looks it dead in the eye, and says, "I am another Escoffier." A healthy ego has the clear-eyed self-confidence to say, "You know what I don't love? I really don't love getting in the kitchen and timing sauces with a stopwatch. I love a big salad bar." And now, wouldn't you know it, I'm hungry. I'm going to go knock together a big salad, and I'll talk to you next time. Bill. Imagination and Junk is written by Bill Barole in the U.S. and Matt Ricardo in the U.K., with audio production by Bill Barole. For more information, show notes, and bonus content, it's imaginationandjunk.com.